So you're thinking about self-publishing a book. You've heard self-published authors can make more money, especially on a per-copy basis. You like the idea that you have more control over both the inside and the outside of the book. And you want to have better access to marketing data so that you can sell more books more effectively. But self-publishing a book can be daunting. There's so many factors involved. Writing the book, editing, formatting, choosing a cover design, uploading it to Amazon, figuring out what KDP stands for, setting up sales pages, advertising, and promoting your book. Not to mention all the work that went into building a platform and growing an audience so that readers actually know that you have a book for them to read. So self-publishing or indie publishing is not for the faint of heart. If you're just getting started in the world of book publishing, everything I mentioned may feel overwhelming, but you don't have to do it all yourself, and you don't have to do it all by yourself, and you don't have to do it all at once. But it is very helpful to know what to work on next and what the process looks like, and that's what we're going to talk about in this episode of Novel Marketing, the longest-running book marketing podcast in the world. I'm Thomas Umstead Jr., CEO of Author Media, and this is the show for writers who want to build their platform, sell more books, and make a living writing books worth talking about. And we have a guest on the show today who's here to help us navigate through the jungle of self-publishing. He knows a thing or two about this. He's been helping authors self-publish for a very long time. He's the co-host of the Self-Publishing Show, which is a podcast with Mark Dawson that has over 3 million downloads. James Blatch, welcome to the Novel Marketing Podcast.
Thank you, Thomas, very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So why is self-publishing? Why does it feel so overwhelming for so many people?
I think there's a lot of moving parts to self-publishing, all of which you might think at that stage you've got to master in order to be successful. And unfortunately, there's some truth in that. You do have to master these different areas. But the good news is you don't have to do everything at once when you're starting out. And that's really what we do in our education, is compartmentalize stuff and try and get people to focus on a particular area. So Facebook ads, for instance, is a subject you do need to master at some point, but not at the beginning. Understanding how covers work is something you probably do need to know towards the beginning. Understanding how editing works and your relationship with an editor, that's the sort of things you can focus on. So once you compartmentalize it, I think it does become easier. But I don't know, does that feeling that it's overwhelming ever fully go away? It's like probably any immersive business, that's part of the fun.
I think the biggest thing that makes it overwhelming is not knowing how something is done and assuming that it's really difficult. I know a lot of people who've done all of the work to make their book. They have the cover and they assume that putting it on Amazon is really difficult. And there are companies that will come in and say, for $5,000, we'll get your book on Amazon. They're like, oh, thank you so much. And what they don't know is that this is an hour and a half process. This is that final step of uploading your book to Amazon isn't that complicated, but it does require some sweat, both in the figuring it out the first time and in the doing it when you get around to it.
Yeah.
Let's just go through the process and let's start with writing the book, because a lot of people think that the writing is the same for traditional and indie publishing, and it's similar, but with traditional publishing, as you're crafting the book, you're thinking about that acquisitions editor. You're thinking about that agent the whole time. And that's really the first person that you have to thrill with your book. While when you're writing a indie book, you're not thinking about the editor or the agent, you're thinking about the reader. And often you're thinking about the specific subcategory on Amazon that your book is going to fit in, right? This isn't just a dragon book. This is a aliens and dragons hunting book. So walk us through the writing of a book if you're going to start from scratch to write a book for the indie market.
I don't think it is obvious to people that they're writing for readers at the beginning. I think if you talk to a lot of people who think they've got a book in them, they imagine themselves writing a literary book, a Margaret Atwood or Ian McEwan book. It's not many people who think, I've got a book in me and my book is like a Lee Child book. I don't think they think that. They think more literary terms. And so I think understanding the difference between the sort of book that you see on posters at the railway station that's published by HarperCollins, which might be the new Margaret Atwood, is a literary book. It probably fits into a genre broadly, but it doesn't have to because it's got a big advertising campaign behind it and a well-known author. You're not Margaret Atwood. You're unlikely to be, and I don't mean that in a rude way, but they are freaks of nature, the people who go right at the top of the tree. So you're writing into a genre, and the way you sell your book is exactly as you described it. is it fits very neatly into a genre. So in the trad industry, they call it commercial fiction. And that's the lifeblood of indie, commercial fiction, genre fiction. So I think that's a really important thing to understand. Now, write what you want to start off with to just get into writing and find your voice. But then when you come to write your book that you think is going to be a book, to get to where you described, Thomas, which is to think about that subgenre, I think that is already a bit of a journey most people haven't considered.
I think a lot of people do it wrong the first time. The first book they write, they just write the book because they want to write a book. And they don't realize that they need to know exactly what subgenre their book needs to fit in until after they've written the book. And this is why I really encourage people not to publish your first book first, because that first book was for helping you learn to write. That first book is not going to be your smash hit. And as Larry Correa says, this is the one industry where you're judged your whole career by your performance in your rookie season. Most athletes, their rookie year is not their best year, right?
Yeah.
They're kind of figuring it out their rookie year and they peak much later. But if you're writing a series, you're writing an epic series of 21 books, let's say, that first book is what everyone's going to use to judge the whole series, even when book 17 is much better written because you're much more developed as an author. But the other big difference is Margaret Atwood, she's just trying to determine what shelf that she fits in the physical bookstore. And depending on the size of the bookstore, they may have a fiction shelf and a nonfiction shelf, right? Yeah. Maybe they have a few sub shelves, but most bookstores don't have a lot of subcategories. It's very broad. And as long as you get placed on the right shelf, everything works out. Whereas with indie, the vast majority of the money is made online, where there are tens of thousands of shelves, and knowing specifically which category that you fit in online is really critical, because you're not going to be on that physical bookshelf. And don't believe anyone who will tell you, oh, we'll get you into a bookstore. To get into a bookstore, you need a sales team. Even a publisher has to have somebody sell the bookstore and convince them that they need to put this book on the shelf and not this other book on the shelf. And so the money is made online. Money is made majority in ebook for most indie authors. And that's an important thing to understand, that the kind of people that you're selling indie books to primarily are Kindle owners, not the kind of person who walks into their bookstore in their neighborhood and asks the bookseller what book to buy.
And they're buying books because Amazon spotted what their tastes are and is putting things in front of them. It's a very different buying environment. It's a bit like walking into the bookstore and the assistant knowing quite a lot about you, what you read, the last 100 books you've read, and then jumping in front of you every now and saying, what do you think of this one? What do you think of this one? That's what it's like in Amazon. It doesn't feel like you're being harassed in that sense, but that's the environment you're writing into. You're right.
I want to move on to editing, because editing is also different. With traditional publishing, editing is more of an emotional journey, because you are given this editor who has a lot of authority and power over you, and you're given a tug of war with the editor over how the book should look. And this is actually beneficial, especially for beginning authors, because that editor has more experience than a beginning author and has the authority to push back on things, be like, hey, it really will be better if you make these changes. While if you're an indie author, you're hiring the editor. They're your employee. You have all the power in the relationship, and you don't have to listen to the editor's suggestions, and no one is forcing you to hire a good editor. So it's very easy, and a lot of indie authors will do this. They'll get their English teacher from high school, or they'll get their friend who got an English degree to edit their book. So the challenge of editing is very different, and the experience of editing is really different for indie authors. So what advice do you have for somebody who they finished their first draft and they know it needs editing? What do they do?
The first thing I'll talk about is the difference between the various types of editors. So broadly, there are three: a developmental editor, a copy editor, and a proof editor. And the copy editing and proof editing, it gradually gets less editorial and more technical. So ultimately, proofing is moving the commas and making sure that the grammar's correct and the spelling's correct. Copy edit is a bit about your style and consistency. And development editor is a lot about style, story, does it work, fairly major things. I've never been trad published, don't want to be trad published, but I imagine that it's mainly development that sort of two-year writing process is about, when they go backwards and forwards on the story and character journey, and they don't worry so much about the copies editing later. That's probably the way we should be looking at it as well when we first start. My first book, I absolutely would not be here having published and three books and writing my fourth without going through that development editing process. In fact, I used a book coach, which is a new thing that sort of sprung up around the indie industry, which is basically development editing as you go along. It's even better than writing your book completely in the dark, 100,000 words, and handing it to a development editor who has to read the whole thing and go back over what doesn't work in it. What happens with the coach is you write chapter by chapter and you go back to get emails. So you'll be writing your next chapter. You get notes on the previous chapter. So you can make those changes and start correcting things you're getting wrong all the way through. I found that absolutely invaluable. And I would strongly recommend development editor when you're starting out. It's a bit like having a university lecturer hold your hand and teach you on the job.
And that's one of the reasons why I really recommend short stories, especially for authors first getting started, because it's a lot easier to get feedback on your short story than it is to get feedback on your 100,000-word novel, right? It's less of an ask. If you're paying somebody, it's less cost. If you're getting feedback from readers, it's less of an ask for them. And you want your reader magnet to not be the first short story you ever wrote in your life. Because that's not going to be your best short story, right? If you've been writing short stories as you go and you've got a collection of dozens of short stories, you're like, this is the right one to use as a reader magnet. That makes for a much better first impression than your very first effort out of the gate. But one thing I will say about developmental editors, the kind of person who's a good developmental editor is typically not the same kind of person who's a really good copy editor. Because one person's very big picture, one person's very details and grammar and rules. And one mistake some indies make is they fall in love with their editor and they have them do all of the steps. And even if they are a magical unicorn who's good at both, you get blind as an editor to the errors, the same way you as the author get blind. And so even somebody else who's not quite as good, but they have fresh eyes, will actually see more things and bring more feedback. And so I really think it's important to have a team of editors work on it, which you actually get with traditional publishing, depending on the size of the house, although it's sometimes behind the scenes. You have the primary editor that you're interacting with, but that editor often is subcontracting, so to speak, to other people in the company to do specific kinds of edits.
And exactly that happened to me with my first book. The development editor did the copy edit. And he said, I've been through this book so many times, I'll be amazed if it needs a proof editor. And it was full of typos. Because we both read it. So exactly what you just said, actually. We'd both read it so many times, couldn't see the wood for the trees anymore. And that was a mistake, which I learned to have a separate proof editor afterwards, a separate copy and proof. And there's a sort of online marketplace for editing services, editorial services, called readsy.com, readsy.com. Every editor I've used has come from there. Bar the very first development editor, who was a podcast interviewee of mine. And yeah, I find it really useful. So that's a good place for you to find a separate development copy and proof editor. And yeah, 100%, I will never use the same editor to do those three stages again. Paid the price.
And another thing I'd recommend is don't hire one developmental editor, hire three developmental editors, have them all edit the same chapter, pay them all, and then pick the best one to finish the book. Readsy is great. We have a job board at authormedia.social that's free. You can find an editor there. But whatever you do, don't go with just one, because then you're trying to make a decision of, do I get it edited or not? And that's not a good decision, because you're going to need to get it edited. What you want is to make the decision of which of these editors will do the best job for this book. Because just because somebody's a good editor for somebody else's book doesn't mean that they're the right match for your genre or for your voice or for your style. And the only way to make that decision is when you're making apples to apples comparisons. And that's what's really nice about a site like Readsy, is that it's basically an unlimited number of editors. And you can whittle it down to three or four that you think are a good fit. And then you do an audition. Some editors will say, I'll edit a page or two for free. If you're on a budget, that's fine. But I really like the idea of paying them for a chapter and getting that paid work. And I think editors should get paid for their work. What they're doing is important. A worker is worthy of their pay. Don't have them edit the whole book. And it's not an insult if they don't get the final job, right? It's like, hey, I went with this other person, they're a better fit, but I want to keep you in mind for the next project.
Yeah. I think I'm actually going to change my development editor. He's done a good job on my last couple of books, but I want to move on a little bit from the kind of male fragility stuff, which was thematic in my books. And he's good at that. And it's one of his areas. And I think potentially I might have put a bit too much weakness into what ultimately was a strapping test pilot in my last book. And I did get a few comments from people saying, don't think you get to that stage with that amount of doubt about yourself. So it sort of felt like I'd probably run the course of that theme. And now my book is the same universe, but it's more espionage spy. And I'm quite happy to go a little bit more machismo in this book. And it's also, I think, good for me to have a different development editor, for all of us to get a different perspective, someone else to come into your writing, point things out that the other person may not be seeing anymore.
So I want to point out something that James just said here, because this is a very indie way of thinking. He's thinking about his team, what editor he wants for the particular book and the style. And it's like, oh, this new book's going to have a slightly different style, and I want slightly different people who play to that style. That's a level of flexibility that you do not have as a traditionally published author. You can't make those kinds of subtle shifts. You're with the editor that you're assigned at the publisher. If you really have conflicts, you can ask for a different one. But it's not like being a movie producer where each film you bring on different actors to make the movie, which as an indie author, you're able to do. It's like, okay, I'm making this kind of book. I need these very specific kinds of editors. I need this very specific kind of cover designer in order for it to fit. And so this is a really great kind of unique perspective that James is somebody who's been swimming in the indie ocean for years. You don't even think about how special that is. But yeah, for a traditionally published author, that's a very different way of thinking.
And the analogy with film's good, isn't it? Because your studios would think carefully about assigning a director to a film based on its theme and its tone and its genre and its subgenre and their work, and they'd get somebody in who's got that background.
So we talked about writing and editing. Now let's talk about typesetting, which is taking that Word document and turning it into pages that are actually readable on a Kindle or a paper book. This used to be this big, complicated process. Now I feel like everyone just says use Vellum.
Yeah.
But what do you have any? Vellum is a Mac-only app.
I'm afraid I'm going to say use Vellum because I use Vellum. I don't know. And I like, you know, the thing is, Vellum is it must be really annoying for people who don't have Macs or don't use Vellum, because we are like the most zealous campaigners about it. It is a lovely bit of software to use. I'm a big fan of Brad and Brad, who are the ex-Pixar people who designed it. And it's a very pleasurable part of the process for me. And then it gets even easier, I think, the formatting, which is nothing to be scared of. There are lots of different ways of doing it. Vellum is a very pleasurable, easy way of doing it. But actually, you can format inside Draft the Digital, which is an online service for free. You can format inside Readsy.
Atticus has a formatter.
Atticus. So yes, there's a bit of work to do depending on what service you use. Vellum probably is the lightest touch from a user point of view, because it does a lot of that stuff in the background, and you're just, as you might expect from two Pixar guys, you're just making it look pretty on the front, and the back end spits out all the technical stuff that is going to be recognized by KDP when it's uploaded. There are stylistic choices to make, which you probably won't have come across before. A bit like me, you're suddenly thinking, what font do I use? I mean, I've never been a particular font guy. I know people get passionate about fonts, and I just use the default that comes on my email, etc. But actually, it does mean something in writing. There are a set of fonts that romance writers prefer, particularly on front covers, even on the inside and the chapter headings and the scene breaks, which could be a very thin line in a thriller, but might be a bit of a flourishy thing in a Regency romance, needs to be right. So you're thinking about stuff you never thought about before, but I've enjoyed that process. And frankly, if you say you go into ChatGPT or even Google and say, suggest to me a font for a thriller book, it will give you five fonts that are very common in thrillers and for every other genre. So the answers are quite easy at hand.
And the easiest hack for this is to just, if you're writing a thriller, open up your favorite thriller and use the interior font that author used. You'll always be safe following the first goose in the line when it comes to fonts. I would be very cautious about using a font that no one in your genre has ever used before, especially for your first few books. That kind of innovation requires some expertise to pull off. But you start to think about things like this, and not just font, but also page color, right? Do I have white pages? Do I have creamy pages? Like things that somebody like me never really noticed about a book suddenly are having to make these kinds of decisions. And you actually appreciate the physical books more, I think, having gone through the process the first time with your own book.
This is something I've discovered. I like white, but it ultimately, I think it feels like a home printed book, whereas cream feels like a book you bought from a bookshop. I'm not really sure where white and cream fit in the trad world, when one's used, when another's used, but cream feels to me, when I look back and think about the books I read, and I've probably got some old books on my bookshelf, I'll have a look at them. I think they're all cream, aren't they?
Well, they all turn into cream eventually.
Yes. Because
the acids used to break down pulp for recycled paper, and a lot of paper has some element of recycled paper, those acids continued to break down the paper over time, causing a yellowing in time. And the lower the quality of the paper, the faster the yellowing, which is why, say, a newspaper yellows so quickly. And why, if you're making a scrapbook, it makes big noise about, oh, this is acid-free paper, which means no recycled products. It's all virgin pulp used in this process. But most books don't yellow that quickly. The kind of paper that are used by the big printers, it's not newspaper quality. It's closer to that scrapbook quality. But as we're talking about the book, we've got to talk about the cover. Because this is how people judge your book. Yes, there's an old proverb about not judging a book by a cover. And it's a proverb that no reader follows. I think the biggest mistake I see indies making is they pick a cover that they like. And they think that the purpose of the cover is to be pretty and that it's something that they like. And you can have a cover that you like that is a completely worthless cover from a publishing and marketing perspective. So when you're advising somebody on a cover, or you're putting together a cover for one of your indie books, how do you approach it as a professional indie?
It's interesting. You said something about the fonts, which is very relevant here, which you said you'd be very cautious about using a font that nobody else is using in that genre. So in other words, you want to fit in with the genre. Exactly the same theory applies to the cover. And it's a bit counterintuitive because a lot of people think, oh God, there's a million thrillers with the guy walking away from camera into a dark alley. So I want my book to stand out. So I'm going to do something completely different. It's going to be a house and so on. It's going to really stand out on the shelf. Well, I'm here to tell you that is the wrong approach. You don't want to stand out. You want to fit in. You want your book to be one of those million that looks exactly like that. Why? Because your cover, as you said, is not there to be pretty or the one that's going to win an award in an art gallery. It's there to do a technical job, and its technical job is to immediately indicate to a reader that this is the type of genre that they read. Or, just equally important, it's the type of genre they don't read, because you don't want somebody picking up your book thinking it's one thing and it's another, because that's the fast route to bad reviews. Your book should fit in and not stand out. It's the first concept you need to understand when coming up with a cover. And this might be a moving feast. It was a bit for me. I did a very traditional cover with a guy walking away from camera to start off with. Then I worked out that my book fitted into a slightly different subgenre of people who were interested in aircraft and aircraft carriers and tanks and stuff. And they tended to feature the vehicle on the front cover. So we actually redesigned my covers after a year based on that intelligence to fit in with that subgenre. And now my book looks exactly like Dale Thomas or whatever with the aircraft on the front. So you do need to do a bit of research and be prepared to react to this. But fitting in, not standing out, what are the tropes? What are the immediate indicators that need to be there to signal to a reader that this is a book in that particular genre? And then don't overthink it. The other mistake I think people make is they say to the cover designer, now there's a brilliant scene set in Brussels, but it's just outside the restaurant and he's got blonde hair. He's talking to a woman who's wearing, it's got to be knee length, Matt, because I described it as the knee length. None of this matters, because the reader hasn't read the book at this stage. And they won't remember when they get to that scene that that was the front cover anyway. So don't get bogged down. And it's really annoying for designers to get these nitty little changes they have to make because of the way you described it in the book. None of that matters. Be relaxed. Remember, your cover is doing that one job.
And the one job is making people curious to learn more about the book. In a perfect world, the job of the cover is to sell the book. But people often aren't ready to become a customer just off the cover. The purpose of the cover is to get them to click. And if you're indie, really is getting them to click. How the cover looks in a thumbnail size is more important than how it looks on the physical copy. Because for every one person who sees a physical copy of your book, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people will see the thumbnail version of your cover. And so it has to be simple. And a lot of those fiddly details of, oh, it has to be a knee-length skirt, people can't even tell the difference at the thumbnail size, right? That's only when it's blown up, when it's 6 inches high on a book cover or full screen, that people start to notice those kinds of differences. And this is one of the pitfalls that indies will get, is they'll send a PDF of their cover to their friends or their fellow authors. And they'll say, what do you think of this cover? And they're all seeing this full screen version of the cover and giving feedback on it. And they're wanting to add complexity to the cover. When in reality, you should be sending this, you know, postage stamp version of the cover and asking people what they think of it and asking people, what genre do you feel like this fits in? And if they can't pick your genre, and by genre, I don't mean thriller. What James was saying about, oh, I realized that my cover was a thriller cover and it really needed to be a military thriller cover. And that's actually a whole different design vocabulary. That's a really key insight, because the kind of people who read military thrillers, they're probably not reading spy thrillers. Some of them will, but some people just read military thrillers. And being a successful indie is about fitting very comfortably in your genre and being able to gather in that subgenre's readers. And if you do that well, maybe they'll spread the word to other readers outside of the subgenre and you grow the pie. But you're not going to grow the pie by being a different kind of food altogether.
I always think about this journey, kind of customer journey. It's a very sort of corporate way of looking at it. But if you think you're driving down a motorway and everything has to align for them to stay on this road. So if at this point you've chosen the wrong genre, you've been carried away with your friend's advice and you've suddenly got this over complex cover that doesn't really say anything, it's confusing. And there are loads and loads of examples of this on Amazon, by the way. That person turns off at that point. So you've not kept them on the road. So we're going to come on to other things in a minute. We're going to talk about blurbs and so on. Each one of those is equally important at reinforcing the same thing over and over again. I have written a police procedural set in Florida. This is a police procedural. So the text and the story have to deliver the tropes that people who read police procedurals expect. Otherwise, you're going to get bad reviews. Your cover has to say at a glance, this is a regional police procedural. Your blurb has to reinforce that again. Your tagline reinforces that. All of this has to align to keep that person on the motorway. And by the way digital marketing works is 10,000 people set off on this journey. You're lucky if less than 1% make it through to the end to buy your book. That's a numbers game. But you will widen the number of people, that percentage from 0.5% to 1.5% is the difference between making a loss and making a very good profit.
That's right. And if you're wanting more help with covers, I have a bunch of other episodes. Basically, all of these topics, we're doing a big overview in this episode, but I have episodes that go into more detail. And we have one episode that's specifically about how to put together a design brief on your cover so you can have a good conversation with your cover designer, because there is a lot to learn here. And everything James is saying is really important. And you need to be crystal clear on who your book is for and what your book is about. And the clearer you are, the more you can put that into your design brief, the more you can put that into your blurb and all the rest of it, the clearer it will be in the minds of your readers, which means it will be clearer in their mouths when they recommend you via word of mouth. Because that's the whole goal of this marketing, is to get enough people to give your book a taste that they will then talk about it. Because the only way to become a bestseller is for people to talk about your book. And if it's not clear in your head, it will never be clear in their mouths, which takes us to actually getting the book on Amazon. So now we have effectively two PDFs, right? We have the PDF of the interior, the typeset version of the paper book, and we have an EPUB of the interior, and then we have a PDF and maybe a JPEG of the cover. And this is the point where people freak out, because they're like, oh no, how do I turn these files into a book that people can actually buy on Amazon? So is this a really complicated, scary process, James?
It really isn't. It was partly complicated when I first started doing this, because they had a separate company called CreateSpace that Amazon bought in, and they were fiddly. Do you remember CreateSpace? You've been publishing a long time, so you know, you're even before that. And now, honestly, it could not be easier. It's like filling in a form. You're answering questions. Put your EPUB here. Oh, yeah, there's my EPUB. The blurb, which you will write at that point, I would strongly recommend this is something you spend a few days on and don't suddenly think at the time you're uploading, because you'll be asked to write your, we call it the blurb, the book description, I think is probably how Kindle describe it inside. When you're uploading, that is a thing you spend as much time on as the cover and everything else we've talked about. But yeah, otherwise you're just answering questions. I mean, there's a couple of new questions now, isn't there, Thomas? You have to say whether the robots have been involved in your book, which is a new thing, which hopefully, you know, right. Most of us are still ticking no at the moment, but that will be yes in the future, I think, for lots of us, in maybe some aspects of the cover design. And you're choosing genres, your categories to go into. And there's a lot of help out there on what categories to go into. This stuff is important. That's become less complicated than it was 2 months ago. Now, there's just three and you select from them. Dave Cheston, who's a bit of a nerd on the metadata, and categories, he did a very informative YouTube video explaining that some of the categories you get to choose aren't real categories, and your book won't be able to rank in them and won't get a bestseller tag if it gets to the top, because there'll be no top to get to. So there's a little bit of research work to do there. But mostly people are going to be putting their books into major categories. And that's it. I mean, it is a simple process, right? I'm not oversimplifying because I do it all the time.
Back when I was a kid, we had to chisel our EPUB files in HTML by hand with stone chisels. It was so hard.
You had to carve it onto a mountain in South Dakota. Yeah.
That's right. You don't know how good you've got it. Yeah, it really is that easy. We'll link to that video by Dave Chesson. He's the go-to guy. I just interviewed him a few episodes back, specifically about Amazon blurbs and descriptions. If you haven't yet heard that episode, you really should go and check it out. He's got this new description generator, which will take your description and rewrite it to make it better. And it's shockingly good. It's very, very good. It's not going to replace you. You still have to write a good description for it to build off of, but it will do some really good things with it. But it's just as much work now, I would say, to do it yourself as it is to hire a company to do it, because the company is going to have to ask you all those same questions.
Yeah.
And you're still going to have to answer all those same questions. In fact, I'd say it's easier to just type them into the box yourself and click next than it is to email back and forth with somebody and hope they do it right. So there's no reason to go with some company that will quote unquote self-publish for you. Just go to Amazon directly. KDP does the ebook and KDP Print does the paperback book. The complexity of indie publishing gets easier every year. The steps get simplified. The tools get better. And if you're trying to decide whether or not to indie publish, the complexity of the publishing bit shouldn't be your determining factor, because it's not really any more complicated, I would say, than traditional publishing. The parts that are more complicated is the hiring the editor, that being responsible for the cover design, where you're making the decisions on the cover design, because that requires you to have some good taste and to do some research. And a lot of authors skip the research part. They don't look up the similar books in their subgenre and they just want a cover that they want. So now we have a book for sale on Amazon, or maybe we have a book that's a pre-order. Right? For your first book, I definitely recommend doing a pre-order so that you have time to make fixes. It takes a couple of days. Nice to do that on a pre-order page no one's looking at than trying to do it during launch day and you're freaking out. So give yourself some time. So now we have a book. It's on pre-order. Let's talk about promotion. Obviously, every episode we talk about promotion, but as the self-publishing formula, what would you say are some of the like critical promotion tactics that every author needs to try?
So I think in those early days, you have to look at it as audience building. We should be thinking about making money when we have a decent series and something called read through. People like book one enough to read book two. People in business know this. They've known this for years. They've known that your first year in business is probably going to make a loss. Your second year, you should aim to break even. Your third year, you can go into profit. That's how we should think about it with books. Book one, not going to make money. Book two, starting to be able to get some return on your advertising investment. Book three might be your profitable moment. And when you've got, like Mark Dawson has 35 books out, you can start counting the numbers in front of the decimal point if you get everything else right that she has. So I think in those early days, just have a mindset that you're building audience. And one of the most important things that we can do is to have a mailing list. A mailing list of readers who like us, who like our books. I started building my mailing list even before I'd published my book. Just started running some simple Facebook ads with the cover that I had designed saying, coming soon, join my mailing list to get on the list. It was quite expensive campaigns, but it got me going. It got me the first few hundred people who were excited about buying a book with a Falcon, which is a bomber aircraft, which is on my front cover. And the beauty of building this mailing list up is that when you come to launch book two, you've got a warm audience who are going to help you launch book two. And that will continue to escalate as you go through your career. And having that audience, that mailing list, is as important with books one and two as it is with books 35 and 36. It's a crucial part of it. So if you learn one thing out of the myriad complex world of marketing books, learn how to build a mailing list.
Joanna Penn asked me that exact same question on her podcast. And I was like, mailing list. And she's like, see, Thomas is saying it too. And I'm going to say the same thing. Look, James is saying it too. But we all agree that the mailing list is critical and it's so effective. I've done many tests and I have yet to find anything that converts better on a per person basis, on a CPM basis, or on a per dollar basis Nothing ever hurts better than the mailing list. And the act of building the mailing list forces you to start thinking about your reader, because you're like, oh, I got all my friends on my mailing list, all the ones who wanted to join. Now I have 25 people on my mailing list. I'm going to have to find some strangers. And that's really good for you to do, right? It's like, Oh, I have to be able to talk to strangers about my writing in a way that's compelling. And it gives you a chance to start practicing that. And you can start building your mailing list if you have a reader magnet before your first book comes out, and you get to practice promoting a book really early on in the process. And it helps you mature as an author while simultaneously building an asset that builds on itself. And even if you're going traditional, that's often the number your traditional publisher most cares about. How many email subscribers do you have on your mailing list?
Even more important than social media followers, I would say, which again, ultimately you don't own your followers, and they're a bit more ephemeral. There are people out there who want to be your fans. And the mailing list is a way of turning readers into fans who feel a bit close to you in that sense. And then turning some of those fans into super fans, the advocates, the ones who are going to go out and forward the email. And some of those will become an important part of your business eventually. They'll be what we call ARC readers, advanced copy readers. So you'll send advanced copies of your book for people who are familiar with what you write, familiar with the universe you write in, and they'll help you make sure your book's going to be as good as it can be when it goes out to publication. So all sorts of myriad uses, not least the fact that it's an enjoyable process having a mailing list.
And in email, there's that reply button, which allows your readers to very easily communicate back with you, and you get that dialogue. And the better you understand your readers, the better you control them. Because you have your idea of who your reader is, but then you have your actual readers mailing you back. And that is really rewarding, but it's also very useful from a marketing perspective to understand who your audience is. So let's talk briefly about advertising, because I know this is a big part of your approach.
Yeah, the days in 2009, when Kindle came along, you could write your thriller book and upload it, and you'd be guaranteed readers because there was a scarcity of material, and the people who'd had their early Kindles were devouring everything. Gradually, using these various social media platforms like Facebook, that has changed into a much more competitive environment, and the organic reach of those platforms is limited. And it's been limited deliberately by Mark Zuckerberg, because it's a commercial entity, Facebook, and he wants you to pay to play. So if you want to reach beyond your followers and be well beyond that, which you need to sell books, you need to pay and place that. So that means you need to go into the advertising ecosystem. And this is one of those things that does look complicated from the outside, but it's absolutely within the reach of everybody. You do need to spend some time learning it. There's no shortcuts to that. But it's a way of then, once you know the techniques and the optimization, it is probably the main show in town for driving traffic to that page you've created on Amazon and getting eyes on it. And it's a numbers game. Again, you want 25,000 people there to sell, if you're lucky, 500 to 700 books. So you need to get those numbers there as cheaply as possible. The other major player is Amazon Ads, and then there are a couple of other platforms below that.
And this is where that book cover and the blurb, where the rubber meets the road, and you get to find out if your book cover actually fits the audience that you're targeting.
Yeah.
Because you get to see those numbers very clearly when you're buying ads of like, oh, wow, my last book was getting this really high click-through rate, and this book is getting this really low click-through rate. I think the cover is the problem. And it's not uncommon for indies, once they start getting that advertising data back, to start making tweaks. They are changing the blurb. They're trying different covers to see what works. And it creates a very quick feedback loop in an iterative process that actually increases the quality of the book everywhere. Because now that you have a cover that works on Facebook, well, guess what? It's now working better on the organic search results on Amazon. It's working a little bit better on the shelves, where you're able to get it on the shelves. And so advertising has some nice ripple benefits beyond just the immediate sales that you're getting from the ads that you're buying.
And isn't that brilliant that we can learn all that? In the old days, of the Mad Men days of advertising, when that old adage was that half of all advertising works, we just don't know which half, was the level of precision available to us now, being able to identify what's not working.
I will say this about advertising. It can get very expensive because you're paying money on a per-click basis or a per-impression basis for the advertising. And so the first thing that I recommend that people spend money on before they start buying ads is that they pay for education for ads, because that often will pay for itself many times over. You can learn these lessons yourself doing your own experiments, but it's time expensive and it's money expensive. Now, I have not tried your advertising for authors program, but I know that you have a program that will take people through this learning curve. So tell us a little bit about advertising for authors and also about the self-publishing formula.
We have two main courses, and one is called Launchpad, and it's actually the main bulk of our conversations really pertain to that. So we always say it's from after you've written the end on your manuscript. So we don't cover the craft of writing, and we don't cover the editorial side of things, not in any detail. But what we do cover is everything else, how to create your KDP account. We have a ScreenFlow that does it bit by bit with you, how to open your Apple account, your Google account, if you want to do those, how to make a decision about whether you're going to be exclusive with KDP or whether you're going to go wide, what that means and what that does, all the way through to cover design and cover choice and to formatting. So that's called Self-Publishing Launchpad, and that is the course, if you are just starting out in self-publishing, that will show you all those nuts and bolts, and this is a constantly updated and evolving course. The next course is a slightly more advanced course, and this is something we'd recommend after you've published your first book or two, and this is how to really master advertising, and it's called Mark Dawson's Ads for Authors. The main module in there is Facebook Ads for Authors. You're absolutely right to point out it's a quick way of losing money if you get it wrong at the beginning, but we'll also teach you how money's not really lost as long as you know how to analyze the data you get back from it. Even if you haven't made money on it, you've learned something, because every time you splash out on a few ads, you're getting incredible data, and where to find that and how to use it is part of that course. And there's a detailed course on Amazon ads in there as well.
And we'll have links to both of those courses, as well as to the self-publishing podcast, which is an excellent podcast that really goes deep on self-publishing. There may be an interview of me on there that you get a chance to listen to if you want to check that out. And that's at selfpublishingformula.com. James Blatch, do you have any final tips or encouragement?
I think it's hard. Writing books, I think it's one of the best things I've done in my life. Probably having children was higher, but one of the best things I would say I've ever done in my life is to write a novel and publish it. I think it's really hard to do that. It would be a shame to go through all of that and then not put some time and effort into learning how to get it in front of readers.
Well said. Slightly less rewarding than giving birth to a real human child is giving birth to your book baby. James Blatch, thank you so much for joining us today on the Novel Marketing Podcast.
I've loved it. Thank you.
Our featured patron today is D. Lynn Mickelson, MD, author of The Good News File, Hope for a Modern World. Life has its problems, but if we stay focused on the positive, we will lead happy and successful mental, emotional, and physical and spiritual lives. This book is a 50-year collection of inspirational stories and quotes. Think chicken soup for the soul. It has something in it for everyone, young and old. D. Lynn Mickelson, MD, thank you so much for being a patron of the Novel Marketing Podcast. Thank you for your support helping keep this podcast on the air. I could not do this without you. The Novel Marketing Podcast is a production of AuthorMedia.com. Our guest today is James Blatch. Our producer is Lloyd Christine. Audio engineering by William Umstadt. And the blog post is crafted by Shauna Lettler. To read the blog version of this episode, visit AuthorMedia.com/395. I'm Thomas Umstadt Jr. saying thank you for listening, and live long and prosper.